they somehow must be our doing, and depend on judgments that we hold and thus might be able to change. 1. The general principle. Stoicism starts with the idea that our experience of the world, our reactions, fears, desires, all of it, is not produced by the world. It is produced by what the Stoics call our judgments or opinions. Seneca, Epistles 78:13. Everything depends on opinion. Ambition, luxury, greed, all look back to opinion. It is according to opinion that we suffer. Each man is as wretched as he has convinced himself he is. Cicero's expression of the Stoic thesis. Cicero, Tusculan Disputations. Grief, then, is a recent opinion of some present evil, about which it seems right to feel downcast and in low spirits. Joy is a recent opinion of a present good, in response to which it seems right to be elated. Fear is an opinion of an impending evil that seems unbearable. Lust is an opinion about a good to come, that it would be better if it were already here. How Epictetus put it. Epictetus, Discourses 3:3, 18-19. For what is weeping and wailing? Opinion. What is misfortune? Opinion. What is discord, disagreement, blame, accusation, impiety, foolishness? All these are opinions and nothing else. Epictetus, Enchiridion 5. Men are disturbed not by the things that happen, but by their opinions about those things. For example, death is nothing terrible, for if it were, it would have seemed so even to Socrates. Rather, the opinion that death is terrible, that is the terrible thing. So when we are impeded or upset or grieved, let us never blame others, but ourselves, that is, our opinions. The first line of this last passage from Epictetus was a favorite of Montaigne's. He inscribed it in Greek into one of the beams in the ceiling of his study. Montaigne, that the taste of good and evil things depends in large part on the opinion we have of them, 1580. An ancient Greek saying holds that we are tormented not by things themselves, but by the opinions that we have of them. It would be a great victory for the relief of our miserable human condition if that claim could be proven always and everywhere true. For if evils have no means of entering us except through the judgments we make of them, it would then seem to be in our power to dismiss them or turn them to good. Montaigne on Democritus and Heraclitus, 1580. Things in themselves may have their own weights, measures, and qualities, but once we take them into us, the soul forms them as she sees fit. Death is terrifying to Cicero, coveted by Cato, indifferent to Socrates. Health, conscience, authority, knowledge, riches, beauty, and their opposites all strip themselves bare when they enter us and receive a new robe of a new color from the soul. Let us therefore find no excuses in the external qualities of things. What we make of them is up to us. Our good or bad depends on no one but ourselves. Montaigne, that the taste of good and evil things depends in large part on the opinion we have of them, 1580. Comfort and poverty depend on the opinions we have of them, and riches, glory, and health have only as much beauty and pleasure as is attributed to them by their possessor. Each of us is as well or badly off as we believe. The happy are those who think they are, not those who are thought to be so by others. And in this way alone, belief makes itself real and true. Or as Montaigne said elsewhere in the same essay, that which gives value to a diamond is our having purchased it. To virtue, the difficulty of it. To devotion, our suffering. And to medicine, its bitterness. Compare Shakespeare, Hamlet 2:2. Hamlet, there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Schopenhauer, The Wisdom of Life, 1851. It is not what things are objectively and in themselves, but what they are for us, in our way of looking at them, that makes us happy, or the reverse. 2. Stoic practice. As stated so far, this first teaching might seem to be a way to understand the workings of the mind and where our reactions come from. It is that. But Stoicism differs from some other philosophical traditions because it is an activity, not just a theory. If we view the idea of this chapter in that way, it is an instruction to take more responsibility than usual for one's thinking, to treat how we talk to ourselves as a choice. If distress is caused by our thoughts about things, rather than by the things themselves, we should try dropping those thoughts and using new ones. That claim may sound so elementary, or perhaps so much easier said than done, as to barely be worth making at all. But it does have to be said, because treating thoughts and judgments as matters of choice is central to the practice of Stoicism, but something that many people rarely do and some never do. It is more normal to take for granted whatever ideas and opinions pass through our minds, living them out with no more scrutiny than we give to the air we breathe. Stoics try to get enough separation from those mental events to control them, to notice the irrationality that drives much of what we say to ourselves, and to replace it with something wiser. Sometimes this is indeed easier said than done, or even impossible. But sometimes, to the contrary, it is easier than it sounds. You stop saying one thing to yourself and say another instead. Later you work on judgments less verbal in form. Squashing a noxious and conventional thought is a wholesome source of Stoic satisfaction and an ability that improves with practice. Consider some examples of our first Stoic teaching expressed this way by Marcus Aurelius, not just as an interesting idea to think about, but as a practice useful to try. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 4:7. Take away your opinion about it, and "I have been harmed" is taken away. Take away "I have been harmed," and the harm is taken away. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 5:2. How easy a thing it is to push away every thought that is disturbing or out of place, and to be at once in perfect peace. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 6:52. We can choose to have no opinion about a thing, and not to be troubled by it, for things themselves have no power of their own to affect our judgments. An example from Seneca. Seneca, Natural Questions 3, Preface 15. What is important? To raise your life high above chance occurrences, and to remember that it is a human life, so that if you are fortunate, you know this will not last long, or if you are unfortunate, you know that you aren't really, if you don't think you are. There is some risk that these passages, taken in isolation, could seem to encourage a kind of vacuity. The goal of the Stoic, though, is not to empty the mind, but to clear it of foolishness and misjudgment. Learning to identify foolishness and misjudgment will be the work of the chapters to come. In the meantime, we may recall that neither of the authors just shown was seeking a placid or retiring existence or a mind free from complexity. Each of them, in their times, was among the most powerful people on earth. 3. Comparisons. The Stoics claim that our reactions to all things are created by the thoughts or subtler judgments that we have about them. They seek to show this first by asking us to look at ourselves more carefully. Some of our reactions, when viewed in a dispassionate mood, seem obviously to be the results of our own sensitivities. Seneca on Anger, 2:25-3. When pleasures have corrupted both mind and body, nothing seems to be tolerable, not because the suffering is hard, but because the sufferer is soft. For why are we thrown into a rage by somebody's cough or sneeze, by negligence in chasing a fly away, by a dog that gets in the way, or by the dropping of a key that has slipped from the hands of a careless servant? But sometimes the conclusion isn't so obvious, and in that case, the Stoics' favorite way of proving the claim of this chapter is by use of comparisons. If a reaction that seems natural isn't found elsewhere, maybe it isn't so natural. Perhaps it is up to us. The Stoics start by comparing our own reactions to similar things in different circumstances. thus demonstrating that the reactions aren't inevitable even in ourselves. They especially like to consider our strong but inconsistent responses to whatever we find annoying. The inconsistency shows that those responses reflect more on us than on the things we curse. Seneca on Anger, 3:35-5. These same eyes of yours, which at home won't even tolerate marble unless it is varied and recently polished, which don't want limestone on the floor unless the tiles are more precious than gold, once outside, those same eyes look calmly at the rough and muddy pathways and the filthy people they mostly meet, and at the walls of the tenement houses that are crumbled, cracked, and crooked. What is it, then, that doesn't offend your eyes in public, but upsets them at home, other than your opinion, which in the one place is easygoing and tolerant, but at home is critical and always complaining? Cicero's account of the Stoic view used the same general approach, comparing how the same people react to identical things in different ways when they bring different judgments to them. Cicero, On the Ends of Good and Evil, 3:13. The mere fact that men endure the same pain more easily when they voluntarily undergo it for the sake of their country than when they suffer it for some lesser cause shows that the intensity of the pain depends on the state of mind of the sufferer, not on its own intrinsic nature. Or as Montaigne put it more concretely, Montaigne, that the taste of good and evil things depends in large part on the opinion we have of them, 1580. We are more sensitive to a cut made by a surgeon's scalpel than to 10 wounds by sword in the heat of battle. Next, the Stoic suggests that we think of others who react more strongly than we do to an event or any other provocation. From our vantage point, those others look hypersensitive. But we seem different to ourselves, not hypersensitive, only because we take our own sensitivities for granted. When everyone shares a weakness, it no longer looks like a weakness. It looks like the state of nature. Seneca, Epistles, 71:23. Those things with respect to which everyone is weak, we regard as hard and beyond endurance. We forget what a torment it is to many of us just to abstain from wine, or be made to get up at daybreak. These things are not essentially difficult. It is we who are soft and slack. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, 6:57. To someone with jaundice, honey tastes bitter. To one with rabies, water becomes terrifying. To small children, a little ball is a wonderful thing. Why, then, am I angry? Do you suppose that mistaken thinking has any less effect on us than bile has in a man with jaundice, or than the poison has in someone bitten by a mad dog? Montaigne, that the taste of good and evil things depends in large part on the opinion we have of them, 1580. In the same way that studying is a torment to the lazy, so is abstinence from wine a torment to the drunkard, frugality a torment to the extravagant, and exercise a torment to the delicate and the idle. And so it is with all the rest. Things are not that difficult or painful in themselves. Our weakness and cowardice make them so. This style of thought can be applied not just to the sensitivities that others have to suffering and annoyance, but also to the behavior, and especially the extremes, to which their beliefs drive them. Beliefs that may seem strange to us, but no stranger than ours would seem to them. Montaigne, that the taste of good and evil things depends in large part on the opinion we have of them, 1580. Any opinion can seem important enough for someone to die for. The first article of the fine oath the Greeks swore and defended in their war against the Medes was that everyone would sooner exchange life for death than their own laws for those of Persia. How many people in the wars between the Turks and the Greeks accept cruel deaths rather than reject circumcision for baptism? Or think about those who react less strongly than you do to something. If you see them putting up with things that you can't, it makes your reaction seem more clearly to be your own doing. Thus, Seneca's conversation with his own pain, which he belittles by thinking of people who endure the same or worse without complaint. Seneca, Epistles, 24:14. In truth, you are only pain. The same pain that is despised by that wretch who is ridden with gout. that the dyspeptic endures for his fancy foods, that a girl bears bravely in childbirth. In this passage and others, the Stoics often are shown to speak of despising pain or other externals, or as having contempt for them. In English, the words contempt and despise are often used to suggest varieties of hatred. In this book, they do not necessarily have that shading. They usually suggest viewing a thing as small, as unimportant, as something to which we should rise superior. And one can have any or all of this without the overtones of vituperation and dislike. Cicero, The Tusculan Disputations, 2:20. When you have seen children at Sparta, and young men at Olympia, and barbarians in the amphitheater, receive the severest wounds, and bear them in silence, will you, if some pain happens to brush against you, cry out? Will you not rather bear it with resolution and constancy, and not cry, "It's intolerable, nature cannot bear it"? I hear what you say. Boys bear this because they are led on by the wish for glory. Others do it out of shame, many out of fear. And yet are we afraid that nature cannot bear what is borne by so many, and in such different circumstances? Montaigne, That the Taste of Good and Evil Things Depends in Large Part on the Opinion We Have of Them, 1580. We cope with the pains of childbirth, deemed to be great by doctors and by God himself, through our many rituals. Yet there are entire nations that make nothing of them. Never mind the Spartans. Among the Swiss women who walk among our foot soldiers, what difference does childbirth make except that, as they trot after their husbands, they carry on their backs the infants that just the day before they carried in their bellies? As these examples suggest, Stoics are known to engage in casual anthropology, sometimes very casual. The reader may not be impressed by the sophistication of their discussion of childbirth, but the important point is the spirit of these inquiries. Convention and habitation have a remarkable power to affect our judgments. What we are used to seeing others do, and what we are used to doing or feeling ourselves, can make anything seem normal or strange, inevitable, or a matter of choice, and those forces tend to do their work invisibly. Once we take in a custom or habit, the judgments they produce feel as though they are strictly our own, not anything that was implanted and could be different. The spell of familiarity must be broken, and this is best done by looking at the great range of responses to the same things that have come to seem natural to people in different conditions. 4. Food. We don't need to look to Sparta or sword fights to find good topics for the types of comparisons just shown. As a case study, consider some ways the principle of this chapter can apply to food, a common subject of Stoic reflection. Reactions to what we eat feel unavoidable as we are having them, and seem to be brought about by the food rather than anything in ourselves. But those reactions often owe as much to us as they do to what is on the plate. The Stoics are close students of the appetites that produce our reactions to foods and all else. Seneca Epistles, 1:23, 2:3. My baker is out of bread, but the overseer, or the steward, or my tenants, all have some to offer. Bad bread, you say. Wait, it will become good. Hunger will make even that bread taste delicate and seem to be from the finest flour. For that reason, we should not eat until hunger bids us. I will wait until I can get good bread, or cease to be fussy about it. Cicero, Tusculan Disputations, 597-99-100. Who does not see that appetite is the best sauce? When Darius, in his flight from the enemy, had drunk some water which was muddy and fouled by cadavers, he declared that he had never drunk anything more pleasant. The fact was, he had never drunk before when he was thirsty. Compare, to those who use moderation, those you see sweating and belching, being overfed like fatted oxen. Then will you perceive that they who pursue pleasure must attain it least, and that the pleasure of eating lies in having an appetite, not in being glutted. Our topic in this chapter is the role of our own judgments or opinions in producing our experience. An appetite can be considered an example of such a judgment. if judgments are understood to include all those things within us that shape our reaction to what we meet in the world. From a certain point of view, this is obvious. On the one hand, there is food, an external thing. On the other hand, there is how much we want it, a judgment of our own. Still, it might seem surprising to describe the appetite for food as a judgment in the Stoic sense, because we feel it as a physical fact. Our hunger or thirst presents itself as a sensation of the body, not as something in the mind that we might be able to change with our thinking. But the Stoic would challenge those impressions. First, our appetites often are up to us in advance. We may have trouble changing them once they exist, but we have a lot to say about whether and how they arise in the first place. Stoics become more aware not just of how our appetites affect our experience, but of how our choices affect our appetites. We allow ourselves to get hungry, or not. We tantalize ourselves with comparisons and other thoughts that stir desire, or we don't. The management of appetites, when and how to cultivate them, when and how not, is part of Stoic practice. Cultivation is called for in cases like the one Seneca describes above, as when learning how to take satisfaction from simple and natural pleasures. All this is an example of the reorientation the Stoics recommend in general, spending less energy on getting or avoiding things and more on knowing why we want them or don't, and how the way we think might affect this. We will come back to these points in later chapters. Second, though, the Stoic wouldn't concede too quickly that appetites, even once they exist, are physical facts entirely beyond the reach of the mind. Of course, great hunger may be a hard fact of that sort, just like other kinds of pains and sensations. But in this setting and others, it is easy to forget how strongly our minds can influence the sensations that external things create for us. A food that looks delicious can become impossible to enjoy and cause physical revulsion if you hear something disgusting about how it was prepared. You might say then that you've lost your appetite. It is not much better, it may even be worse, if the mind makes such a discovery afterwards. Plutarch on Moral Virtue, 4, 442 F. Very often when men have eaten fancy foods with great pleasure, if they perceive or learn afterwards that they have eaten something unclean or unlawful, not only is this discovery attended by grief and distress, but their bodies, revolted at the notion, are seized by violent vomiting and retching. Montaigne gave a more picturesque illustration. Montaigne on the Power of the Imagination, 1580. I know a gentleman who, having entertained a large group of company at his house, a few days later boasted as a joke, for there was nothing to it, that he had fed them a pie made out of a cat. One of the young ladies in the party was so stricken with horror that she developed a violent stomach disorder and a fever. It was impossible to save her. Food interests the Stoic in another respect as well. It provides a useful source of analogies from the way the stomach works to the way the mind works. Seneca on Benefits, 5, 12, 6. Just as the stomach, when it is impaired by disease, gathers bile, and, changing all the food that it receives, turns every sort of sustenance into a source of pain, so, in the case of the perverse mind, whatever you entrust to it becomes to it a burden and a source of disaster and wretchedness. Such comparisons were recurring themes for Plutarch, who wasn't a Stoic on the biggest questions, but was with them on this and other more immediate issues. Plutarch, on Tranquility of Mind 8, 468F to 469A. In a fever, everything we eat seems bitter and unpleasant to the taste, but when we see others taking the same food and finding no displeasure in it, we stop blaming the food and drink. We blame ourselves and our malady. In the same way, we will stop blaming and being disgruntled with circumstances if we see others accepting the same events cheerfully and without offense. Plutarch on Virtue and Vice, 4, 101C to D. Have you ever noticed how sick people turn against and spit out and refuse the daintiest and most expensive foods, though people offer them and almost force them down their throats? But at another time, when their condition is different, their respiration is good, their blood is in a healthy state, and their natural warmth is restored, they get up and enjoy a good meal of simple bread and cheese and cabbage. Such also is the effect of reason on the mind. Dr. Johnson continued the idea, though reversing the facts of the illustration. Johnson, the Adventurer, number 119, 1753. What we believe ourselves to want torments us, not in proportion to its real value, but according to the estimation by which we have rated it in our own minds. In some diseases, the patient has been observed to long for food, which scarce any extremity of hunger would in health have compelled him to swallow. But while his organs were thus depraved, the craving was irresistible, nor could any rest be obtained till it was appeased by compliance. Of the same nature are the irregular appetites of the mind. Though they are often excited by trifles, they are equally disquieting with real wants. The Roman, who wept at the death of his lamprey, felt the same degree of sorrow that extorts tears on other occasions. Johnson refers to an anecdote told by Plutarch. Crassus and Domitius were Roman generals. Crassus was ridiculed by Domitius for weeping over the death of an eel-like fish that he owned. Crassus replied that the tears were more than Domitius had shed over his three late wives. Food has been offered here just as an example of how Stoics might think about something familiar. Much of the stuff of daily life can be put through the same sort of analysis. Lest the reader think Plutarch was too preoccupied with food, for instance, here he opens a different field of application to which many of the points just made may be adapted. Plutarch on Moral Virtue 4, 442e. Another illustration is the banishment and retreat of our private parts, which stay calm without trembling in the presence of those beautiful women and boys whom neither reason nor law allows us to touch. This happens in particular to those who fall in love. Then hear that they have unwittingly fallen in love with a sister or a daughter. Then desire cowers in fear as reason takes hold, and the body exhibits its parts in decent conformity to that judgment. 5. Metaphors and analogies. The Stoics offer a vision of the mind and the role it plays in turning objects and events into an experience felt by the self. We don't have good literal language for describing that role. The mechanisms of the mind aren't visible to us in a way that allows for exact depiction. So as we just saw, the Stoics resort at times to figurative comparisons and analogies that make their ideas easier to see. Some further examples: Epictetus, Discourses 3:4:20. Like a bowl of water, so is the soul. Like the light falling on the water, so are the impressions the soul receives. When the water is disturbed, the light also seems to be disturbed, yet it is not disturbed. Seneca, Epistles 71:24. It takes greatness of mind to judge great matters. Otherwise, they will seem to have defects that in truth belong to us. In the same way, certain objects that are perfectly straight will, when sunk in water, appear to the onlooker as bent or broken off. It is not so much what you see, but how you see it that matters. When it comes to perceiving reality, our minds are in a fog. From Plutarch. Plutarch on Virtue and Vice 1, 100b to 100c. Clothes seem to warm us, but not by throwing off heat themselves, for in itself every garment is cold, which is why people who are hot or have fevers frequently are constantly changing clothes. Rather, the clothes that wrap us keep in the heat that is thrown off by the body, and don't allow it to be dissipated. A somewhat similar case is the idea that deceives the mass of mankind, that if they could live in big houses and get together enough slaves and money, they would have a happy life. But a happy and cheerful life does not come from without. On the contrary, a man adds the pleasure and gratification to the things that surround him, his temperament being, as it were, the source of his feelings. 6. Implications. This chapter has introduced the most basic idea in the practice of Stoicism, that our reactions to all things are of our own making, even if they don't seem that way, and that we underrate our power to rid ourselves of the ones that serve us poorly. We can end the chapter with some reflections on the fundamental nature of this point. From Epictetus, Epictetus, Discourses 2, 11, 13. Behold the beginning of philosophy. perception of men's disagreement with one another, and a search for the origin of the disagreement, rejection and distrust of mere opinion, and inquiry to see whether an opinion is right or wrong, and the discovery of some standard for judgment, just as to deal with weights we discover the balance, or for straight and crooked things, the ruler. Epictetus's description, taken broadly, can indeed be viewed as an account of how Stoic philosophy came into being in general, and also of how it might begin for anyone who studies it. We see others talking or thinking or acting differently than we would, or differently than we had imagined anyone might, the disagreement to which Epictetus refers. This causes us to take our contrary thoughts and customs less for granted, and to see them as more dependent on choice and circumstance than we had supposed, the rejection and distrust of mere opinion. We are led to look harder at our own thinking, and to seek a more true and accurate basis for it, the acquisition of the balance and ruler. The result may not be our old opinion, or the alternative that surprised us. It may be a perspective that accounts for both, and in some way elevates our understanding. Run through that cycle 1,000 times, and you might reasonably end with the principle discussed in this chapter. We have reviewed some specific examples of that cycle, but the point goes beyond any particular case. It isn't that our reaction to this or that is created by our own minds. It's that our experience of everything is, and that it is up to us to a greater extent than we usually know. The work of philosophy is to take responsibility for our own thinking, and in so doing to liberate ourselves from the attachments and misjudgments that otherwise dictate our experience. 2 more ways to summarize the point of this chapter. Epictetus, Discourses 4:3-7. Pay attention to your impressions. Watch over them without sleeping, for what you guard is no small thing. Self-respect and fidelity and self-possession, a mind free from emotion, pain, fear, disturbance, in a word, freedom. Cicero, Tusculan Disputations, 4:31. It seems to me that in this whole doctrine about mental disturbances, one thing sums up the matter, that they are all in our power, that they are all taken on as a matter of judgment, that they are all voluntary. This error, then, must be uprooted, this opinion stripped away. And just as things must be made tolerable in circumstances we regard as evil, so too in good ones those things thought to be great and delightful should be taken more calmly. We can find a good closing remark for this discussion in what Cicero said to close a related discussion of his own. Cicero, Tusculan Disputations, 4:38. Now that we have determined the cause of these disturbances of the mind, that they all arise from judgments based on opinion and by choice, let there be an end to this discussion. Besides, now that the boundaries of good and evil have been discovered, so far as they are discoverable by man, we ought to realize that nothing can be hoped from philosophy greater or more useful than what we have been discussing for the last 4 days. For besides instilling a proper contempt for death and making pain bearable, we have added the calming of grief, as great as any evil known to mankind. For there is one cure for grief and other ills, and it is the same. They are all matters of opinion, and taken up voluntarily because it seems right to do so. This error, as the root of all evils, philosophy promises to eradicate utterly. Let us therefore devote ourselves to its cultivation and submit to being cured. For so long as these evils possess us, not only can we not be happy, we cannot even be right in our minds. Chapter 2. Externals. A great share of Stoicism amounts to the study of externals, what they are, how we misjudge them, and the ways that they tend to enslave us. An external can be defined as something outside ourselves, or outside our power. Later chapters will talk about specific examples, such as money, fame, and calamity. Before we reach those cases, though, this chapter considers 2 sets of Stoic teachings about externals as such. First, a principal aim of the Stoic is to regard externals without attachment. This has consequences, first, for the decisions and developments that one spends energy fussing about. If Stoics are distinguished by one policy as an everyday matter, it is a refusal to worry about things beyond their control, or to otherwise get worked up about them. Detachment also means not letting happiness depend on getting or avoiding externals, wealth, for example, or the good opinion of others. Now a qualification. Of course, everyone will have preferences about those externals just mentioned, and many others. The Stoic would rather have wealth than not have it, and would prefer to do without adversity. But we have to distinguish between preferences and attachments. The difference between them can be seen most easily by comparing how you feel when they aren't satisfied. Imagine wanting one thing more than another and not getting it, but not being too upset as a result. That sort of wish is what we might call a mere preference. Having what you prefer is pleasing, and not having it is a disappointment, but it's no threat to your equanimity. And the same can be said when something happens that you would have preferred not happen. It is just spilled milk. And Stoics try to look at all things they can't control in roughly that way. An attachment is different, because it makes your happiness depend on the object of it. It pushes and pulls you. This distinction will be discussed more in later chapters. For now, we can just say that Stoics try for an equilibrium based on the quality of their thinking and their actions, one that doesn't depend on anything beyond their control. The second general Stoic teaching about externals is that we have a hard time seeing them accurately. Externals fool us, or we fool ourselves about them. Stoicism offers some ways to get past those deceits, as by taking a literal view of an external that seems exciting or scary, or by breaking it down into parts that one can see more clearly than the whole. Stoics look this way at objects, but also at people, whose reputation or wealth, or lack thereof, can cloud our judgments of them. The Stoic tries to see things as they are. The teachings of the first chapter can be linked to the teachings of this one. The first chapter was about things that are up to us. This chapter is about things that are not up to us. To say it a little more fully, Chapter 1 showed the claim that we are affected by our judgments about events, not by events themselves. We therefore have more control than we think over what we experience. This chapter is the other side of the coin. We attach ourselves to externals that we imagine we can control, but really can't, and deceive ourselves about them routinely, habits that make us unhappy and unfree. So, in effect, these first chapters suggest a reversal. We waste our energy on things that aren't up to us, and are barely conscious of the things that are up to us. Stoicism is the effort to turn that around, and to move one's center of gravity to a more useful location. 1. Things not up to us. The Stoics all have their specialties. This chapter belongs first to Epictetus, whose most constant refrain was the urgency of renouncing desires and fears that depend on externals. Epictetus, Enchiridion 1. There are things up to us and things not up to us. Things up to us are our opinions, desires, aversions, and, in short, whatever is our own doing. Things not up to us are our bodies, possessions, reputations, offices, or, in short, whatever is not our own doing. Epictetus, Discourses 4:4-39. There is only one road to happiness. Let this rule be at hand morning, noon, and night. Stay detached from things that are not up to you. Epictetus, Discourses 4:10-1. Man's perplexity is all about externals. His impotence about externals. What will I do? How will it take place? How will it turn out? Let this not happen or that. These are all the cries of people worried about things that aren't up to them. For who says, how can I avoid agreeing to what is false? How can I not turn away from what is true? If there is anyone whose nature is so fine that he is anxious about those things, I'll just remind him, why are you distressed? Rest assured, it's up to you. Epictetus, Discourses 2:16, 11-14. What do we admire? Externals. What do we spend our energies on? Externals. Is it any wonder, then, that we are in fear and distress? How else could it be, when we regard the events that are coming as evil? We can't fail to be afraid. We can't fail to be distressed. Then we say, Lord God, let me not be distressed. Moron, don't you have hands? Didn't God make them for you? So are you going to sit down and pray that your nose will stop running? Better to wipe your nose and stop praying. What then? Has he given you nothing to help with your situation? Hasn't he given you endurance? Hasn't he given you greatness of spirit? Hasn't he given you courage? An aside for those who share my interest in the etymology of insults. Moron comes from Greek, where the word transliterated into English was moros. It was an adjective, but Epictetus uses it as a noun, as one might do in English by saying, Now listen, stupid. Returning to our theme via Seneca. Seneca Epistles 23:2. A man reaches the heights if he knows what makes him joyful. If he has not made his happiness depend on things not in his power, he will be troubled and unsure of himself so long as it is the hope of anything that spurs him on, even if it is not difficult to get, and even if his hopes have never disappointed him. Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius Meditations, 641. Consider those things outside your control that you regard as good or bad. When the bad things happen, or the good ones don't, you inevitably will blame the gods and hate the people responsible, or who are suspected of it. We do great injustice through our disputes about these things, but if we judge as good and bad only what is in our power, there is no occasion left to accuse God or take a fighting stance toward men. Some related comments. Montaigne of Presumption, 1580, Not being able to govern events, I govern myself. And if they will not adapt to me, I adapt to them. Johnson, The Rambler, number 6, 1750. The fountain of content must spring up in the mind. He who has so little knowledge of human nature as to seek happiness by changing anything but his own dispositions will waste his life in fruitless efforts and multiply the griefs which he purposes to remove. Schopenhauer, The Wisdom of Life, 1851. The ordinary man places his life's happiness in things external to him, in property, rank, wife, and children, friends, society, and the like, so that when he loses them, or finds them disappointing, the foundation of his happiness is destroyed. In other words, his center of gravity is not in himself. It is constantly changing its place with every wish and whim. 2. Good and evil. The Stoic analysis of externals implies an adjustment of what we call good and evil. The Stoics hold that those properties lie only in what is up to us, our use of judgment, as discussed in Chapter 1. Things and events, then, aren't good or evil. Our minds are. Seneca on the Happy Life, 4:2. Let us say that the happy man is he who recognizes no good and evil other than a good and an evil mind. Epictetus, Discourses, 2:16:1. Where is the good? In our choices. Where is the evil? In our choices. Where is neither of them? In those things we do not choose. The meaning of good and evil to the Stoic will become clearer in the course of the book. Generally, the Stoics identify the good with the rightful use of reason, which in turn leads them to a life led for the benefit of the whole, that is, for others. More immediately, it means avoiding vices such as greed, dishonesty, and excess. Those are viewed as errors that result from attachment to externals, and from treatment of externals as themselves good and evil. So dropping those attachments, in the way our authors have just suggested, is regarded by the Stoic as an essential first step toward virtue. Said differently, things in the world are, as the Stoics sometimes put it, indifferent. We turn them to good or evil with our choices. Epictetus, Discourses 3:24. Is health good and disease evil? No, you can do better than that. What then? To use health well is good, to use it badly is evil. Seneca Epistles 82:14. We speak of a sunny room when the same room is perfectly dark at night. Day fills it with light. Night takes it away. So it is with those things we term indifferent or middle, such as riches, strength, beauty, reputation, sovereignty, or their opposites, death, exile, ill health, pain, and all the others that we find more or less terrifying. It is wickedness or virtue that gives them the name of good or evil. By itself, a lump of metal is neither hot nor cold. Thrown into the furnace, it gets hot. Put back in the water, it is cold. This position allows Seneca an answer to the old question of why bad things happen to good people. They don't. Genuinely bad things occur only in the mind, and the mind of the good person is free from them. Seneca on Providence 6:1. But why does God sometimes allow evil to befall good men? Assuredly, he does not. Evil of every sort he keeps far from them. Shameful acts and crimes, evil counsel and schemes for greed, blind lust and avarice intent on another's goods. The good man himself he protects and delivers. Does anyone require of God that he should also guard the good man's luggage? No. The good man himself relieves God of this concern. He despises externals. Marcus Aurelius turned that idea around and made it a test. Nothing is good or evil if it can happen as easily to a good person as a bad one. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 2:11. Both death and life, honor and dishonor, pain and pleasure, wealth and poverty, all these things happen equally to good men and bad, being neither noble nor shameful. Therefore, they are neither good nor evil. Epictetus also discussed more directly what things we should consider good and therefore regard as sources of delight. Again, he discourages excitement about externals. We should be delighted or not with the quality of our understanding, not with the properties of things that aren't up to us. Epictetus and Chaeridion 6. Don't be elated by a superiority that belongs to another. If the horse in its elation were to say, "I am beautiful," one could endure it. But when you in your elation say, "I have a beautiful horse," be aware that you are elated by the good of the horse. What then is yours? Your way of handling impressions. When you are handling them in accordance with nature, that's when to be elated. For then you will be elated about a good of your own. 3. Externals and liberty. Epictetus had been a slave. He and other Stoics often spoke of dependence on externals as itself a variety of slavery. Someone attached to externals is enslaved to whoever controls them. Stoic philosophy thus is a way to liberation. Epictetus regarded volition or will as one's true self, and as the only part of us that is free. Epictetus, Enchiridion 14. Whoever then wishes to be free, let him neither wish for anything nor flee from anything that depends on others. Otherwise, he must be a slave. Epictetus, Discourses 2:25. If you gape after externals, you will, inevitably, be forced up and down according to the will of your master. And who is your master? Whoever has power over the things you are trying to gain or avoid. Epictetus, Discourses 1:29-60. Man is not the master of man, but death and life and pleasure and pain. Bring me Caesar without these things, and you'll see how calm I am. But when he comes with them amid thunder and lightning, and I am afraid of them, what else do I do but acknowledge my master like a runaway slave? So long as I have only a sort of truce with these things, I'm like a runaway slave standing in a theater. I bathe, I drink, I sing, I do everything in fear and suffering. But if I free myself from these slave masters, that is, from those things by which these masters are fearsome, what more trouble do I have? What more master? It was a lively feature of Epictetus's classroom style that those who worried or complained about externals would customarily be denounced as slaves. Epictetus, Discourses 2:13-17. No good man grieves or groans. No one wails. No one turns pale and trembles and says, "How will he receive me? How will he listen to me?" Slave, he will act as he sees fit. Why do you care about other people's business? Epictetus, Discourses 4:157. In short, if you hear him say, "Wretched me, the things I have to endure," call him a slave. If you see him wailing or complaining or in misery, call him a slave in a toga with purple trim. A toga with a purple border was the attire of Roman senators. Epictetus Discourses 4:155. When you see someone groveling before another man, or flattering him contrary to his own opinion, you can confidently say he is not free, and not only if he does this for a mere dinner, but also if it is for the sake of a prefecture or consulship. People who do these things for petty ends you can call petty slaves, while those who do them for grand purposes can be called mega slaves, as they deserve. Seneca saw all of us as slaves in something like this way. Seneca Epistles 47:1. I was pleased to hear, through those who come from you, that you live on familiar terms with your slaves. This befits a sensible and well-educated man like yourself. They are slaves. Nay, men. They are slaves. No, comrades. They are slaves. No, they are lowly friends. They are slaves. No, they are rather our fellow slaves, if one reflects that fortune has the same rights over them and over us. Seneca Epistles 47:17. Show me who is not a slave. One is a slave to lust, another to avarice, another to ambition, and all are slaves to fear. I will name you an ex-consul who is slave to a little old woman, a millionaire who is slave to a serving maid. I will show you youths of the noblest birth in serfdom to pantomime players. No servitude is more disgraceful than that which is self-imposed. Pantomime players were not silent mimes. They were troops of singers and dancers who would enact scenes from myth and legend. It was a popular form of entertainment in Rome, and the most successful of the players were celebrities. Epicurus quoted in Seneca, Epistles 8:7, "If you would attain real freedom, you must be the slave of philosophy." Compare Montaigne. Montaigne, "Of the Inequality Amongst Us," 1580. True and effective servitude is only a concern of those who willingly submit to it, and those who try to acquire honor and wealth from the labors of others. One who is content to sit by the fireplace, and who knows how to manage a household without falling into quarrels and lawsuits, is as free as a Duke of Venice. 4. Adding nothing to externals. This chapter has been devoted so far mostly to a single Stoic aim, letting go of attachment to externals. A related set of teachings involves the problem of viewing externals clearly. We have trouble resisting externals because they seem appealing or frightening or otherwise impressive. But they seem that way because we haven't learned to see them as they are. Seneca thought it worthwhile to look at our reactions the way we do at the reactions of children. The point is applied to externals we like. Seneca Epistles 1:15-8. How contemptible are the things we admire. Like children who regard every toy as a thing of value, who prefer a necklace bought for a few pennies to their own parents or their brothers. What then, as Aristo says, is the difference between us and them? Except that we elders go crazy over paintings and sculpture, making our folly more expensive. Aristo of Chios was one of the early Greek Stoic philosophers, and a colleague of Zeno of Sicyum, the founder of the Stoic school. The same point as applied to externals we fear. Seneca Epistles 24:13-14. So remember this above all, to strip away the disorder of things and to see what is in each of them. You will learn that nothing in them is frightening but the fear itself. What you see happening to boys happens to us too, slightly bigger boys. Their friends, the ones they are accustomed to and play with, if they see them wearing masks, they are terrified. The mask needs to be removed, not just from people but from things, and the true appearance of each restored. To help with this removal of the mask, the Stoics offer two techniques general enough to discuss here. More specific advice will come in later chapters. First is the practice of adding nothing when an external presents itself. As soon as an event happens, we are quick to assign it a meaning. It is tagged as good news or bad news, as a reason for excitement or outrage, and so on. Or we give it a place in a story that we tell ourselves, long-running or new. Then we react to those labels and narratives and imaginings. Stoicism regards this process as a trap. The assignments of value or meaning that we attach to things are usually half-conscious, borrowed from convention, and false or unhelpful. They nevertheless determine how we feel and what we think and do next. So the Stoics say that our thinking should be slowed down, and imagination should be viewed with distrust, not imagination in its creative capacity, but imagination as the enemy of men, the father of all terrors, as Joseph Conrad once called it. When confronted with a report, or an event, or an object, in short, the Stoic tries to just see it as it is. Any additions are made with care. Epictetus, Discourses 3:8-5. His ship is lost. What has happened? His ship is lost. He has been led off to prison. What has happened? He has been led off to prison. The notion that he fares badly, each man adds on his own. Epictetus, Discourses 1:19-19. I have a headache. Do not add, alas. I have an earache. Do not add, alas. I'm not saying that you cannot groan, but don't groan inside. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 8:49. Say nothing more to yourself than what first appearances report. Suppose it is reported that a certain person is saying terrible things about you. This much is reported. But it is not reported that you have been hurt. I see that my child is sick. I see that much. But that he is in danger, I do not see. So always stay with first appearances, and add nothing from within yourself. Nothing happens to you. Or rather, add something, but do it like someone who knows of all that happens in the world. Guillaume de Vere noted a particular snare when interpreting events, creating false metaphors to describe them, and making other kinds of alarming and misleading comparisons. De Vere, The Moral Philosophy of the Stoics, 1585. Our opinions torment us more than things themselves, and are formed by the words we use when something surprising occurs. For we call one thing by the name of another, and imagine it to be like that other thing, and the image and idea stay there in our minds. Another Stoic technique involves subtraction. It is used for externals that are already known to us, and that we have trouble seeing clearly because they are covered already with conventional meanings. One has to chip away at the romance or horror or other story that has been overlaid onto the thing, and to distinguish between what it is and what it is called. This is really a variation of the process shown a moment ago, seeing things as they are, not as we have been told they are, or as everyone pretends they are, or as we tell ourselves they are. But rather than adding nothing, one takes off what is already there. A favorite Stoic method for the purpose involves viewing a subject in the most literal way possible, or breaking it down into parts that dissolve the formidable appearance it might have, whether of desirability or the reverse. Epictetus and Chaeridion 3. With everything that is beguiling or useful, or that you love, remember to say also what sort it is, starting with the smallest things. If you love a piece of pottery, say, it is a pot that I love, and when it is shattered, you will not be upset. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, 6:13. The thought might occur to us when eating fancy foods that this one is the corpse of a fish, this one the corpse of a bird or a pig, or again that this fancy wine is the dribble of a bunch of grapes, and this purple robe is sheep hair dyed with shellfish blood, or about copulation that this is the rubbing of a little piece of entrail, and, along with some convulsion, an excretion of mucus. Impressions like these are the ones that penetrate to the heart of things themselves, and let us see what they really are. We should do the same in all areas of life, and whenever things appear too highly valued, we should lay them bare in our minds, perceive their cheapness, and strip off the prestige they have traditionally been assigned. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 11:2. You will disdain lovely singing and dancing and martial arts if you will cut up the musical phrase into separate notes, then ask yourself about each one if you are unable to resist it. You won't know how to answer. Do the same with dancing, for each movement or position. The same even with martial arts. To sum up, apart from virtue and the things that stem from it, remember to go over things piece by piece, and by separating them come to look down on them, and carry this over to your whole life. By martial arts, he was referring to Pancratian, which was roughly what we would now call ultimate fighting or mixed martial arts. It was an Olympic event. 5. Judging others. The events and worldly goods just considered are the simplest and commonest examples of externals. But other people also amount to externals for Stoic purposes. We have as much trouble seeing them clearly as we do anything else. Again, Stoics try to strip away their disguises. Seneca, Epistles 115:6. Just as the eyesight can be sharpened and cleared up by certain drugs, if we are willing to free our spiritual vision from impediments, we will be able to perceive virtue even when it is hidden within the body, even with poverty as an obstacle, even where insignificance and disgrace stand in the way. We shall see that beauty, I say, however much it may be covered in filth. Conversely, we will be able to perceive evil and the sluggishness of a wretched mind, however much the view may be blocked by gleaming riches, or however strongly a false light, here of rank and position, there of great power, beats down on the beholder. Seneca, Epistles 76:31-32. None of those who have been raised to a lofty height by riches and honors is really great. Why then does he seem great? Because you are measuring the pedestal along with the man. A dwarf is not tall, though he stands on a mountain. A colossus will maintain its size even when standing in a well. This is the error under which we labor, and how we are deceived. We value no man by what he is, but add the trappings in which he is adorned. Montaigne, Of the Inequality Amongst Us, 1580. The pedestal is no part of the statue. Measure him without his stilts. Let him lay aside his wealth and his titles. Let him present himself in his undershirt. Is his body healthy, active, and able to perform its functions? What sort of soul does he have? Is it beautiful and capable, and fortunate enough to have all of its parts intact? Is the soul rich in what is its own, or rich in what it has borrowed? Has luck had nothing to do with it? Can it face the drawing of swords without flinching? Is it indifferent between a death by the expiration of breath or the slitting of the throat? Is it calm, unflustered, and content? This is what we must see. That is how the great differences between us should be judged. And the same analysis might be turned on oneself. Seneca, Epistles 80:10. Do you see that king of Scythia or Sarmatia, his head elegant with the badge of his office? If you wish to see what he amounts to, and to know his full worth, take off his headband. Much evil lurks beneath it. But why do I speak of others? If you want to take your own measure, put aside your money, your estates, your honors, and look inside yourself. At present, you are taking the word of others for what you are. Scythia and Sarmatia were territories lying in the steppes north and east of the Black Sea. They were often at war with the Roman Empire, and their peoples were regarded by the Romans and Greeks as barbarians. We saw in the previous section that Stoics sometimes look at worldly objects in a literal way. It is a technique for seeing things as they are, and without romance or fear. The same general idea can be applied to people. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 10:19. What are they like when they're eating, sleeping, copulating, defecating, and so on? What are they like when they're being imperious and arrogant, or angrily scolding others from some position of superiority? A little while ago they were slaves, and doing all those things just named. And soon they will be again. 6. Knowing the difference. The first question that Stoics typically ask about any apparent problem or prospect is whether it is up to them. If not, they don't agonize about it, because it wouldn't help if they did. Stoics, therefore, are very attentive to the difference between things within and beyond their control. Epictetus, Enchiridion 1:5. Right from the start, then, practice saying to every harsh appearance, "You are just an appearance, and not at all what you appear." Then examine it, and test it by those rules you have, and by this first one especially, whether it has to do with things that are up to us or things that are not up to us. And if it has to do with something not up to us, let the thought be close at hand that it is nothing to me. Of course, there are mixed cases, situations where we have control over some aspects of a problem but not others, or the power to control it but perhaps not the right or responsibility. Those cases may call for hard analysis, and the Stoics do not spend as much time on them as one might have wished, but the basic approach is set forth by Epictetus. Epictetus, Discourses 2:5-9. It is difficult to combine and bring together those things, the carefulness of one devoted to material things, and the steadiness of one who is indifferent to them, but it is not impossible. Otherwise, happiness would be impossible. It is like planning a sea voyage. What can I do? I can choose the captain, the sailors, the day, the right moment. Then a storm comes upon us. At this point, what concern is it of mine? My part is done. The problem belongs to another, the captain. Detachment from externals should not be confused with withdrawal from the world. As the last part of chapter